talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guests today are Aaron Greenwood and Lee Greenwood. As I've said all too many times in recent weeks, Greenwood and Greenwood sounds like a law firm, and it could easily be one. Siblings Lee and Aaron are both lawyers. Lee is a legislative attorney for Best Friends Animal Society, the National Animal Welfare Organization, while Aaron's a lawyer who no longer practices. They're both skillful writers. Aaron was the animal welfare editor for the Huffington Post, and now writes about animals for the Today Show, the Dodo, the Washington Post, among others. She's also a novelist whose new book, Your Robot Dog Will Die, will be published in April. Lee has written op-ed pieces and letters to the editor about animal issues that have appeared in the Boston Globe, the Sun Sentinel, and other publications. So both Greenwoods are engaged in protecting and promoting animal welfare while doing so from different platforms and different parts of the country. In fact, Lee is on the phone from Boston or thereabouts. Aaron's in the studio. We are going to be doing this, streaming this on Facebook Live, if you'd like to check that out. And we'll find out what sort of family life and formative years spawned these animal do-gooders, the paths they've traveled to work they do now, and more when I speak with Aaron and Lee Greenwood in just a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll also speak with Don Goldstein, the Talking Animals Greyhound correspondent, about the recent move by Senator Tom Lee seeking to end greyhound racing by way of filing a constitutional amendment that would outlaw dog racing in Florida if the amendment passes. Finally, a programming note, actually two of them. First, my thanks to Bev Capshaw and Ronnie Elliott for sitting in for me last Wednesday with a typically stellar show, lots of great animal songs, many of which I hadn't even been aware of before, so thanks to them. And then lastly, on next week's Talking Animals, I'll be discussing sexism, sexual harassment, and predatory behavior in the animal welfare and rescue world. Among my guests will be Carol Adams, the feminist animal rights advocate, author of the landmark book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, and Carol is a towering figure in this world. So I hope you'll join me for that next Wednesday, November 22nd, on Talking Animals. Meanwhile, let's get to Aaron and Lee with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Aaron and Lee Greenwood on Talking Animals. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thanks for having me.
And good morning, Aaron, who's right here across from me in the studio. We actually have face-to-face contact with a guest. Yay! You might want to move the mic just a little bit closer to your mouth. There we go. Now we're starting to hear. There we go.
Hi.
Yay. All right, let's start with what may be the most critical question. Who's the eldest?
Who do you think?
Come on, don't ask that question.
Oh, wow. I think we're starting to get the answer by way of the non-answer.
It's me.
Yeah. Okay.
By 5.5 years.
Well, okay. Not to put too fine a point on it. So, and then, like, are there other siblings?
No, just the two.
Okay, cool. I just wasn't sure if there was a birth order thing beyond just eldest, youngest here that we got. Okay. So, you two have traveled different but parallel paths, as I've just kind of outlined, in the animal world. So, you know, at least that's the shaky premise of my show today, inviting you guys on. So, we'll, of course, trace those paths in a moment or two. But let's find out a bit about the kind of home that spawns two siblings like you. I'm guessing you didn't grow up in a house of hoarders. So, or where animals were otherwise mistreated. So, Lee, maybe you could start with you describing what role animals played in your family when you were growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. So animals, to no one's surprise, I suppose, played a role in a big role in our lives, or certainly in mine. I don't want to speak for air there. But, you know, we always had dogs growing up. We had gerbils. There were always an assortment of cats that lived around the house, outdoors mainly. My mom is pretty allergic. God, there were fish, there was a bunny, there were all sorts of animals living in our suburban Rhode Island house in around.
Okay, well, I'd also ask another question I was going to get to, which is where this was taking place, but Rhode Island it is. Okay. And I guess it's only fair to ask, Aaron, do you have a differing view of the animals? That would be interesting, I guess, as an elder sibling. That's not at all how it happened. That's not at all what the situation was. Do you have any?
Well, it's funny that my brother puts it that way, because the thing that I remember is this stretch of about 6 years where we didn't have a dog. And I remember those as being the unhappiest years, and that we would beg our parents to let us bring home a dog. And they had been heartbroken when the dog that I had when I was a baby had died. And it took them a long time to get over it and to be ready to have a new dog. And I remember promising them every year that I would never ask for anything ever again if only we could get a dog.
Wow.
Yeah. And finally, when I was 12, we got our dog Sunshine, who lived with us for a very long time.
So from 6 to 12, the house was dogless.
Yeah, very sad.
But if I follow Lee's description, there were other animals there, but just not a dog.
Right.
Okay. So it wasn't like barren of fauna of one kind.
No.
Okay.
Heaven forbid.
Heaven forbid.
Yeah, that seems unlikely. Likely from what we're hearing so far, but
that's not a world I want to live.
No, I would think not. And looking back, what sort of, for lack of a better term, like messaging was there, either explicit or implicit, in your family about animals? Obviously, one of them, it sounds like, was like animals are good, because they were certainly plentiful. But was there something else, especially maybe with the 6 years of dog-free thing, was there something else that either of you remember, like that you sort of took from that period?
No, I mean, I think, truthfully, our parents both love animals a lot, but, you know, my brother and I have a special kind of devotion to them that I think honestly came out sort of organically to us both. I mean, when I was very young, 6 or 7 years old, I stopped eating meat. And, you know, as a kid, when it was time to do dissections, I would refuse to do the dissections because I didn't want to kill the animals. But, you know, this was all stuff that I remember picking up sort of on my own. And our parents are supportive and loving and could not have been any better about it. But you know, I think my brother and I both sort of developed this real passion for animals kind of on our own.
And to what extent, with that in mind, well, let me ask you this each separately. It's the same question, obviously, in reverse. But so with what you just said, Aaron, to what degree would you have predicted that Lee would have ended up doing something for a living that involved animals?
I mean, I think it would be very hard to have predicted that either of us would end up exactly on this career path, because it's just not what you grow up even thinking of as possible.
Right.
But given how much both of us love animals, and given also that my brother, I mean, I don't want to speak for him, but I remember him from very young being interested in government relations and lobbying and advocacy. Mm. And so to marry those interests in this career, you know, it makes perfect sense once you see it happening.
Yeah. And Lee, how about you? Did you see, even though it might have been at least initially a little bit hard to predict, was there a certain point where you saw where Aaron was headed, or just that her love with animals was so sort of big and passionate that it's like, okay, well, maybe she is heading that direction?
If I had known that there was a career path for working with animals, I would have pegged her as on that path from day one. But honestly, as Ara said, like, this is not a career that we even dreamed was a possibility. But let me just say that from a day, you know, from a very early age, as she said, like, it was pretty clear that there was a special relationship between my sister and animals, in a way, frankly, that I think was even more pronounced than it was with me. I was always a dog guy. I love dogs and still do. But she really had a connection with animals in a special way from as long as I can remember.
So, yeah, and that's interesting in a way, I guess, because you were really, really young, I guess, during the dogless years, right? So, I mean, but it sounds like, I don't know if that created a further connection with you and dogs once they did enter your life. It sounds like that's been, so dogs are really it for you and primarily, Lee.
Well, I mean, that was my entryway, my gateway.
Your gateway drug?
Was dogs. But you know, I like to think that I've matured into a fully functioning animal lover.
I see. Rounded out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let me let folks know.
Dogs are a passion, for sure.
Okay, cool. Well, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you're just tuning in, my guests are Aaron Greenwood and Lee Greenwood, siblings who are engaged in promoting animal welfare from different platforms. He's a legislative attorney for Best Friends Animal Society. She writes about animals for the Today Show, the Dodo, Washington Post, and others. If you'd like to ask Aaron or Lee a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. And we are streaming this, by the way, on Facebook Live at the moment as well. So nobody could have hinted or predicted the career path, because in many ways, those career paths either didn't exist or that you guys weren't aware that they existed. But let's talk a little bit about the path that sort of put you on there. So Lee, again, you're a legislative attorney for Best Friends Animal Society. What does that mean, and what do you do day to day?
Ask my parents. We're all trying to figure out what I do day to day and what that means. But so what do I do day to day? My job is essentially, I have the best job in the world. You know, no offense to you two, but I get to be an advocate and a voice for cats and dogs in our country. And I work as a lobbyist, as a lawyer across the country, working on legislative issues on the state, local, and federal level a little bit to try to promote responsible dog ownership and responsible laws that help promote cat safety and dealing with community cats. And so I truly do have the best job in the world. It's just a joy every day to get to say that I work for Best Friends. It's special. I love it.
And we've, of course, talked about Best Friends a number of times over the years, but why don't we take a moment and just have you explain more what Best Friends is and what its overall mission is.
Yeah, so Best Friends is a national animal welfare nonprofit organization. We have a very singular mission. Our mission is to end the unnecessary killing of cats and dogs in our nation's shelter system. And you know, we've said that we're going to make our entire country no kill by 2025, and that's a mission that we are incredibly focused on and working really hard to accomplish. And we work, like I said, throughout every single state in this country. We do all sorts of work. We do programming. We do, you know, actual animal rescue and adoption. And then there's the side that I work on, which is advocacy. You know, working with local individuals, with local organizations to try to get good laws passed or to defeat bad laws that would harm animals.
And what would be like a recent legislative effort or a law that you were involved with helping pass that did make things better for animals in a given area or state?
Yeah, so Delaware this year in 2017, Delaware, one of the big wins for us was Delaware became the 21st state to prohibit breed discriminatory or breed specific legislation, you know, BSL or BDL as we call it. And that was a huge win. That was an effort that, you know, it took a couple of years to get through and worked with a lot of great sponsors in Delaware and the state legislature, worked with a ton of great advocates on the ground there. And we did a lot of work there. You know, we drafted the bill, we hired the lobbyists, we were there doing all the testifying, and the state passed it. And we had a great signing ceremony with Governor Carney, the Delaware Humane Association. It was a big win for animals and for people who love animals.
Well, I'm going to ask both of you to help answer this because, Aaron, you've written a lot about BSL or BDL. So why don't you describe a little bit just for people listening who may not be familiar exactly what that means?
Sure. You want me to take that, Lee?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So these are laws and regulations that single out dogs by breed or by appearance rather than by behavior. And so, for example, there are a few hundred jurisdictions in the country where dogs known as pit bulls are banned. And, you know, they have all sorts of different definitions of what a pit bull is in these various jurisdictions. But the laws all focus on a dog's breed or appearance instead of what it is that the dog itself is actually doing or what the owners are actually doing. And these are terrible laws that are not effective at promoting public safety. And they're also very expensive to enforce. And they're heartbreaking for the people affected by them and for the animals affected by them.
And Lee, anything I have a question, a follow-up for that, but anything you want to add to Aaron's description?
No, you know, I hesitate to compliment my sister too much, but she did a great job there.
Thanks, Lee.
Well, here's something that you guys could both answer, because when I see or hear BSL or BDL, I kind of only really think of pit bull type dogs. What are some of the other dogs that are sometimes affected by that kind of discrimination?
Yeah, so I mean, people are really surprised by this, because like you said, you know, the first thing that we think about when we think of these laws are pit bulls, and certainly the majority of these laws do focus on pit bull terrier-like dogs or dogs that look like those types of dogs. But we've seen these laws affect a wide range of other kinds of dogs. There's laws in, I believe it was in Kentucky, that impacted German Shepherds. There's laws about Rottweilers, about Chows, a variety of different dogs. And that's only in the municipal level BSL issue. When you talk about insurance issues, which I don't know if we want to get into today, but then you're talking about a much wider range of dogs that are discriminated against.
And with these other ones, that German Shepherds, Rottweilers, Chows, whatever, is there anywhere near the same measure of controversy that often swirls around BSLs or BDLs that do seem to specifically address pit bull type dogs?
So, I mean, honestly, a lot of these laws are relics of decades ago.
Yeah.
These were laws that were passed 10, 20, 30 years ago. And so a lot of times they're just on the books, but people aren't even aware that they exist. So, you know, as far as the generating the media buzz, it's typically going to be your pit bull laws. But again, laws are on the books. And if you have one of those dogs that are impacted by one of these types of horrible laws, whether there's a lot of media attention or not, like, you are impacted by those laws. So that's why we really do fight against these laws wherever they creep up.
So it's more that when they're introduced, like Montreal recently, I guess that's where there would tend to be more furor and controversy, because it is newly introduced, and then the various factions that have strong feelings about pit bull type dogs, pro and con, that's where you really get that sort of charged debate, I guess.
Well, it's there.
Yeah, when they're introduced, or even when they're trying, when there's an effort to repeal them.
So. Or when there's a dog that's affected by it. So when, you know, when a community has BSL and a family gets a notice that they have to get rid of their dog because of this, that can also draw a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And sometimes people find out then for the first time that their community has that kind of a law.
Yeah, sometimes it takes an unusual story. If it has been on, like, a few years ago, I spoke with Mark Buehler, who's this major league pitcher, and I spoke with his wife because he had gotten signed by the Marlins, Miami Marlins. So they moved. They had a pit bull type dog. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't move to, like, where they would near the park and near, you know, headquarters, because there was a BSL in that area of South Florida. And then he got traded to Toronto, that in that province had the same thing. So at that point, they just said, well, we can't keep doing this, and we're not going to do anything to get rid of or adopt out or let go of our dog. So the family, I think, either went back to where they were before Florida, but the point is they did not make that move to Toronto. And so the family was kind of split in a way, just so that they didn't have to relinquish their dog in any way, despite two in a row BSL homes.
Yeah, and they're very good advocates for trying to get rid of these laws. They're terrific advocates, that family.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I would just add, you know, the Burleys are a wonder, you know, a story of truly the connection between your pets and your family, and how your pets are part of your family. But the issues that Mark and Jamie faced, and the kids faced when they were forced with choosing either following him to Toronto, you know, and not being able to keep their family together or not, those are issues that people are facing every single day in these jurisdictions with breed discriminatory laws. And you know, thankfully, the Burleys had the resources and the ability to make those options and keep their family together. But we hear stories. I mean, this is one of the leading causes of animals being surrendered to shelters is, you know, you have to move to a new place, and that new place doesn't allow what your pet is. And you know, people are often forced to choose between their homes and their pets, and that's a heart-wrenching decision that no one should have to make.
For sure. And then the thing I guess you kind of touched on, Lee, is that even apart from places that have official BSL or BDL, you know, you could move to, I guess, a condo, and hopefully you would know this before you moved, but where just the specific condo outlaws moving there with a pit bull type dog. So even if you're not looking at a place that where that law is on the books, you still could be prohibited from moving where you otherwise would like to.
Yeah, finding pet-friendly housing generally, it's not just pit bulls, but finding rentals that will accept pets is one of the key issues in animal welfare right now. Just increasing the number of housing options for people with pets. There was a study by Emily Weiss that I think came out last year or the year before showing that the number one reason pets are surrendered to shelters is because their families can't find a place to live with them.
Mm. By the way, someone smarter than I am has written in to remind me that I should be mentioning for people interested in the Facebook Live thing that that's not on the Talking Animals Facebook page. It's on my own page, personal page, Duncan Strauss. So if you do want to see Aaron and I in studio, fortunately, you cannot see Lee, but you can hear Lee if you do want to go Facebook Live. So thank you for that update. Yeah, so it's not on the Talking Animals page. It's on just the Duncan Strauss regular personal Facebook page. So something you just said, Aaron, makes me think, what else besides the thing you just noted about the difficulty for families finding rental housing that will take it? What else would you say are a couple of the top animal welfare issues at the moment?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think the big thing that gives me a lot of hope right now is seeing an increase in the number of programs to help people hold on to their pets when they're facing hard times. So programs there to help find affordable medical veterinary care for pets that, you know, if there's a dog who's chained up, there's now groups that will build that dog a fence and a doghouse and, you know, and provide food and heartworm medicine and all the other things to help people take care of their pets. You know, an increasing recognition that somebody having a hard time themselves doesn't mean that they don't love their pets and don't, you know, want good for their pets and that they might just need a little bit of help doing that.
And this may overlap a question that came in by email. So this emailer says, and this may be something you could help specifically answer, Lee, but of course both of you are invited to weigh in. Why does it take so long to get an animal out of an abusive situation? It seems like they're always given 48 hours or longer, and in that time an animal could die. How can we change that to hurry up the process? Thank you.
I will say that, you know, there is an increasing awareness of the harms of animal abuse, you know, in our laws, but unfortunately, sometimes the laws don't change as quickly as we would like them to, which is why having an army of animal advocates on the ground who can help make those positive changes in the law are so important. Not really sure about the law that this person's asking about specifically, so, you know, I hesitate to comment on that, but,
sure.
But certainly there is an increasing awareness that animal abuse is a horrible issue in and of itself, but also connected so much to abuse of humans down the line. So there is that more serious attention is being given to that issue, which is great.
But yeah. Also, if you feel that there's animal abuse in your community that isn't being taken seriously, take pictures, you know, contact your animal control officers repeatedly, contact your lawmakers repeatedly, let them know that this is something that you and others in your community care about. You know, if they know that their voters, their constituents care about this, it means that they're more likely to care about it too.
Yeah. So again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guests are Aaron Greenwood and Lee Greenwood, siblings devoted to animal welfare, traveling different paths. Lee is a legislative attorney for Best Friends Animal Society. Aaron writes about animals for the Today Show, the Dodo, and other outlets. Her third novel, Your Robot Dog Will Die, will be published in April. So we invite you to continue to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. And again, if you just joined us, then I should also mention that we are streaming this on Facebook Live on just my own personal page, Duncan Strauss. So, Aaron, let's talk a little bit about your career. And first of all, before we get into the writing, which we've touched on a little bit already, but let's talk about what you were doing before, just because I think that you were, of course, practicing law. One of the little signposts of this invitation today is you guys are both lawyers, both great writers, etc., and siblings, obviously. So what were you doing? Just maybe tell us a little bit briefly what you were doing while you were practicing law that eventually led to this whole other writing thing.
Sure. Yeah, no, I got very, very lucky practicing law. I just got some fantastic opportunities. I started off my career right out of law school, working at a big law firm in New York for about a year and a half, but then moved from there to a U.S. territory out in the Pacific called the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. It's out near Guam. And I got to spend a couple of years at their Supreme Court working as a staff attorney or law clerk for their Chief Justice, and then moved from there to their Attorney General's office, where I just got to do really, really interesting work. Got to represent agencies and argue appeals in the Supreme Court, where I'd been the law clerk. And one of the sort of great joys of my career so far has been helping to start a refugee protection program out there, and then getting to be an administrative judge for it. So I got to hear refugee protection cases and grant refugee protection to people who were in fear of persecution back in their home countries and wanted to stay in the Northern Mariana Islands.
I mean, to me, this isn't the first time I heard this, but then and now, I think it sounds like such really sort of fascinating, rewarding work, and in this, what I assume at least, was gorgeous setting.
So pretty.
Yeah.
So pretty,
I guess the obvious question then is, like, what led to you saying, okay, I'm going to make a change, or I've had it, or enough of this, or what prompted that?
So I had always wanted to be a writer, and honestly, I just never knew how you made a career out of doing it. I thought you had to do something very serious and work in an office, and then you could go home at night and write. But when I was in law school, I started meeting people who were studying journalism and were working as journalists, and started getting to see sort of what that looked like, and just started picking up freelance gigs here and there as a writer, even while I was in law school and while I was working as a lawyer. And just over time, I was doing more and more writing, and starting to think, like, oh, maybe I could do something with this. And then I wrote a book, and my first book called Tropical Depression, which was sort of loosely based on my years on the islands. I don't know. It just became something that I wanted to try to do to see if I could make a real go of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's worked out pretty well, I'd say.
Yeah, it's been great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when in that path did you land at the Huffington Post, and how long were you serving as animal welfare editor there?
Again, this is just like a very, very lucky turn.
People that have a constantly charmed life, there's something else to it that isn't just like kismet or whatever, but please go ahead. Yeah.
So when I left the islands, it was just time. I'd been out there for a little over 5 years, and as you might be able to tell, I'm very close with my family, and it was just too far from them. And I was in my sort of early mid-30s at the time, and you know, I don't know if you've ever felt this, but I was starting to get that feeling like, oh, I'm probably going to want to settle down at some point. And when I do, I don't think I want it to be a 24-hour plane ride from my family.
Mm.
So I came back to the States and ended up moving to Washington, D.C., not for really any great reason. My brother was going there, and I had nothing else to do. And so, my brother and sister-in-law were going there. So I kind of followed them there and started picking up freelance work there. And then just somebody I knew from one of the freelance gigs that I'd done had become the bureau chief for the Huffington Post in D.C., and they were starting up a new site there that was focused on D.C. as sort of a city, not as a political entity. And he asked me if I wanted to come in and work on it. So I said yes.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and over time, I just ended up writing more and more and more about animals, and sort of became the animal welfare editor, basically a couple
just
of
evolved
years
into
before
the...
they actually gave me the title.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And then subsequently, you're writing again for the Dodo, for the Today Show website, for the Washington Post and others. So are there particular stories that, given my druthers, this is what I want to write?
You know, part of what I love about writing about animals, about the animal beat, which I'm sure that you experience too, given your radio show, is just that it is such a full and rich field. I mean, you can write cute animal stories that are based on adorable photos and funny videos, and then the next minute you can be writing very serious stories about, what it means. This is my first piece for the Washington Post, what it means for a shelter to be no-kill, like what that actually means. So, then there's advocacy journalism that you can do in it.
And yeah.
what I love about this beat is how full it is.
I do see the range of stuff. I also think of kind of a sort of quintessential Aaron Greenwood story is something cool that has happened for a dog that in one way or another has had a rough go or is unfortunate or is a senior dog, and like this amazing story that's an amazing human story as much as an amazing animal story.
Yeah, I mean, part of what's... So a lot of these, the rescue stories, you know, or the like what you're describing, I mean, they show both the best and the worst of what humans do for animals.
Yeah.
And part of what I like about stories like that is just that they sort of model how people can do good things for animals. So, I mean, what I sort of think of my overall mission is writing stories that make people feel compassionately toward animals and also show them what they can do to make the world better for animals.
And also can make them cry very easily.
And also make them cry, yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, but that's,
you know. And puns also.
And puns, lots of
right,
puns,
yeah, yeah. Animal puns. Yeah, but again, got to keep so the writer colors. Interested, right? Yeah,
exactly.
So, Lee, I didn't mean to leave you out, and I do have a specific question that one of our emailers asked, which is, how does Lee feel about TNR of Community Cats?
Oh, thank you for asking. I feel wonderful about TNR.
Most people listening probably do know what TNR is, but just in case people have tuned in that may not be familiar with it, let's define that first.
Yeah, sure. So TNR stands for Trap, Neuter, and Return. And what we're talking about is community cats or cats, free-roaming cats, feral cats, stray cats, whatever word we want to use to define them. We call them community cats. So TNR essentially is where cats are trapped, humanely trapped. They are spayed or neutered. There's the N. And then they are returned to where they are. Healthy cats are returned to where they were before. And TNR has been the most effective way of both reducing the community cat population out there, which is everybody's goal, and also giving these cats a chance at life, because the data has all shown consistently for essentially forever that cats that are brought into shelters, especially cats that are not socialized or adoptable, almost always are going to have a bad outcome, and they're almost always going to be killed in the shelter. And that's, both inhumane and also just a totally ineffective way of actually reducing that community cat population. So TNR is a great way to accomplish everybody's goals, and that's why it's one of the main legislative pushes that we do and programming pushes that we do at Best Friends, is work with municipalities, work with states to, make TNR doable in your community.
And along those lines, when you first were describing a little bit about Best Friends earlier in the show, and you described how you're aiming towards the no kill by 2025. So we're 2017, obviously, at the moment. Oh, how is that looking? How is that timetable looking, do you think?
It's looking great. We're going to do this. It's a lot of work. It will be a lot of work. Certainly not just from Best Friends, but this is an entire community-wide effort. But we are going to get there. One of our wonderful leaders at Best Friends really drove a stake in the ground and laid claim to 2025 as the year that we're going to achieve no kill throughout this entire country. And we're on pace. We're going to do it, but we're going to need a lot of help. And that's why we do what we do.
What does Best Friends need to do? But what do others who would share that goal, what are some things that we, just as people talking or listening to this show, what are some steps we could take or some measures we could take to help achieve that no kill by 2025 goal?
Yeah, get involved. I mean, I think that's the key thing. Get involved, however that means, whatever that means to you, whether that's getting to know your city councilors or your state legislators, if you are interested in the legislative side of the things, which is, again, where I do most of my work, go volunteer with your local animal shelter, with your municipal shelter, help out that way. If none of those things help, donate money to an organization that is supportive of no-kill and making our country a no-kill country, something like that. I mean, we all can be a voice for animals in our own way, and that's, I think, the big takeaway. And it's really, it's amazing to see, because there are just millions and millions of folks across this country who are doing it. And people who are busy with their lives, they all, they have their kids, their pets, their whatever, their jobs, but But people are doing it, and we're all doing it together. And it's really great to be a part of that.
Cool. I like that. All right, let's take a caller. We've had some callers come and go. We've got another one back. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Aaron and Lee Greenwood.
Yes, I have a question about euthanasia.
Okay.
The goal of what they're talking, setting forth the no kill in 2025, is fantastic. Hopefully it'll work out. But there's 30 to 40 million animals that will be put down during that time period. And a lot of them will unfortunately be gassed with carbon monoxide. Is there any work being done by the Best Friend Society working against the use of that chemical, that gas?
So you're saying, are there improvements being made to how animals, unfortunately, might have to be euthanized between now and the 2025 no-kill reaching that goal? Is that your question?
Yeah, or especially with the carbon monoxide.
Okay.
I've seen that actually work, and it's very tragic. But yeah.
All right. Well, either Greenwood could probably answer that. Lee, do you want to go first? It was posed to you, but I'm going to guess Aaron has some expertise probably as well.
Sure. I can jump in first, and Aaron can take it from there. But,
yeah.
It's horrible. It's the gassing of animals, as sometimes animals, whether if they actually are truly in need of euthanasia, there are ways that we can do this that are not nearly as horrific as gassing. And there are states out there that actually prohibit that as a means of killing animals. It's something that absolutely is worthwhile to get legislation on the books to prohibit that kind of killing.
Aaron, anything you'd like to...
Yeah, I agree with... for once, I agree with what my brother is saying.
Okay. We'll note that in the history books.
If you are unhappy with what your local shelter is doing or what you're seeing at shelters, speak out. Let those in charge know that this is something you care about.
All right, caller. Thank you for your question. Appreciate it.
Thank you for helping.
Thank you. Okay, we sort of have just about a minute or two left, but I want to address an email that actually came in earlier. And again, one or both Greenwoods are more than welcome to jump in on this. This one says, have you noticed that President Trump's family doesn't have a pet? Isn't he the only president in history that has not had an official presidential pet? I think this speaks a lot about his personality. And how he, all right, well, I think you can see where this is going. But I do think it is historic, right? I mean, I don't know if it is.
It's historic that he hasn't had a pet. I mean, with every president, at least as far as I'm aware, I am not aware of a president before now who hasn't had a pet. Laura Trump, one of the daughters-in-law, is becoming a good animal advocate. But the Trump family overall is known more for big game killing than they are for protection of animals.
Yeah.
Or for having pets.
Right, yeah. Right.
And then, you know what? Let's be optimistic. There's always time, and there's lots of animals that are in need of adoption in Washington, D.C., so maybe they'll go and adopt one. We can only hope.
I like that spirit of optimism, Lee. I really like it. I'm going to try to embrace it even. Yeah. So.
Me too.
Okay. So just in our last moment here, Aaron, why don't you tell us a little bit about, again, you've written, I think, this is the third book, right?
Yes.
That's coming out, and it's Your Robot Dog Will Die. So why don't you give us the nickel tour of what that book is about, so
sure.
We can look forward to it coming out in April.
It is a book that's set in a dog sanctuary in the near future, where the last dogs on Earth are living, and our protagonist is a 17-year-old girl who has grown up in this sort of magical place, and she has pet robot dogs there. And they have the last living dogs there. And then she discovers a sort of dark secret that puts her whole home and the whole community in jeopardy. And she has to rush to save everyone.
Wow.
Save everything she cares about.
All right. Well, if our curiosity isn't piqued, but we do have to wait, I guess, about 5 months or thereabouts, right? But
I'm not a very patient person, so this is torture for me.
I'm sure. That's the novelist's lament, I guess. But we will, of course, remind people, listeners, as we get closer to that publishing date. So, okay, we have one more call, if it could be quick. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Lee and Aaron. We were sort of out of time, but if you have a very quick question or comment, I'd be happy to include that.
There are pictures of President Trump with dogs. He has a habit every year when he can of having a picture taken with the top of the breed show from the Westminster Dog Show. And you will find him with the dogs with the biggest medals with a picture in his office.
Go look those up.
Okay. It sounds like it's like a photo op, if I follow what you're saying, right? I mean, he doesn't have any direct connection with these dogs, correct?
No, they are the only pictures that can be found.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it sounds like you've scoured the internet and archives and everywhere else, and this is what you've turned up, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Dog beauty pageants.
All right. So he's about what we thought he was, but I'm still going to stick with Lee's optimism that things could change in that way. So thank you so much for your call.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so we've been speaking with Lee Greenwood and Aaron Greenwood. Again, Lee is at Best Friends Animal Society, which the website is bestfriends.org. And Aaron, you can find on Facebook without too much difficulty. And there's all kinds. And what's great is a lot of her stories are posted there. And she also seeks input for stories or suggestions and stuff. So she's great in all kinds of ways, Facebook-wise and otherwise. So thank you guys both for joining me today on Talking Animals. It was cool and a fun and I think informative conversation.
Thanks so much for having us, Duncan.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Duncan. This was great.
All right, thanks. In a few moments, I'll speak with Don Goldstein about the constitutional amendment filed recently by Senator Tom Lee in a bid to end greyhound racing. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner, where we have a piece by Drew Hastings called Farming 101 in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Well, it's probably obvious to most of you that I'm a farmer. That's essentially what I do. I farm. Believe it or not, I have not farmed that long. I've only been a farmer about 2 years. I've been an urban guy my whole life. I lived in New York, Los Angeles, I lived in San Francisco for a while, and you know, I was coming on 50, and I said, you know what, to hell with this. I'm gonna go back to Midwest where I'm from. I'm gonna get myself a farm. You know? Well, I'll be honest. I don't even know how I got a farm. My credit score is 6. I had to use my Speedway points on my financial statement. So I get this farm, and I don't know how many of you here have ever lived rural or in the country, but Jesus, it is creepy out there. If you're not, it is creepy. They'll tell you, at night, sun goes down, pitch black. Did you know that at night, possum walking through a cornfield sounds exactly like three men with an axe? Yeah. And what kind of owl makes this sound? You're gonna die. I kid you not, I am not making this up. My place is so far out there, Domino's Pizza will not deliver to me. I've never even heard of anything. Like, I call Domino's now, oh, we don't come that far. You're gonna have to drive up Newmarket Community Center. Pull in the parking lot, flash your lights, we'll meet you. Like it's a drug deal. Do you have the pizza? Yes, do you have the money? Of course I got the money! Did anyone follow you here? They all drive tractors, for Christ's sakes!
Well, that was Drew Hastings with a piece called Farming 101, taken from his CD, Irked and Miffed. Now, on to my conversation with Don Goldstein about that constitutional amendment intended to halt greyhound racing in Florida. This is Don Goldstein returning for, I'm not even sure how many times on Talking Animals. Don, good morning.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you today?
Good. I don't know how many times you've been on the show, but again, we always learn all kinds of great things, especially obviously about the greyhound world, but often there's a legislative bent to our conversations, and this seems to be no exception in a way. So fill us in on what Senator Lee did and what kind of prospects that has and what might happen as a result.
Well, what's got us so excited about this one, Duncan, is this one is not legislative. This is through the Constitution Revision Commission. And it would ultimately, if the amendment passes, it would eliminate or phase out and ultimately eliminate greyhound racing in the state of Florida over a 3-year period. It would also ultimately decouple the card rooms from the requirement to have live races. So it does everything to protect the dogs by phasing it out over a 3-year period. It gives the rescue groups like mine appropriate time to find proper homes for these dogs, whether here in Florida or elsewhere in the country. There's quite a demand for it around the country, actually. So it's a very, very well-drafted amendment. The process now is that it will be considered by the 37 commissioners on the Constitution Revision Commission. It's got two committees to go through. If ultimately 22 of the commissioners approve the amendment, it will go directly to the ballot in November of 2018, and then it leaves it up to the citizens of the state of Florida to decide whether they want to support greyhound racing or whether they want to eliminate it over a three-year period. It would require a 60%, as all amendments do, would require 60% of the voting populace to approve the amendment.
So, as with many things legislatively greyhound-related, this seems a little bit complicated and a little bit of a numbers game. What do you and other greyhound experts think the prospects are of getting those votes that would advance it to the ballot?
We're working very hard. We're communicating with all 37 of the commissioners. The commissioners were appointed by both the governor, the president of the Senate, and the speaker of the House, and they each got a certain number of commissioners. If people want to get involved and express to their commissioners, the next place that this is going to be heard is the General Provisions Committee, and if they'd like to express their opinion to the seven commissioners on that committee, they can go to the Humane Society of Florida's webpage. There is a link there directly to that committee. Or they can go to FLCRC, Florida Constitution Revision, FLCRC.gov, and click on the committee link, and they can then express to those seven commissioners on the General Provisions Committee that we'll be meeting soon.
You kind of anticipated, not surprising, one of my next question, which is for people who do want to try to lobby for this, to influence this, that's the path.
Correct. That's the path. From there, it will go to another committee, the executive committee, and then it will go to the full panel, assuming it gets through those two committees. So it's just hard for me to imagine that if this ultimately gets on the ballot in November of 18, that more than 60% of the people in the state of Florida will choose to eliminate this form of gambling and this form of treatment of animals, particularly greyhounds.
Wait, it's hard for you to imagine that they will choose to?
It's hard for me to imagine that they will not approve
this
amendment. The 60%
okay.
of them would not agree that we need to eliminate. Senator Lee estimates that it will eliminate $200 million worth of gambling in the state of Florida and put that money back in people's pockets.
And again, as we've discussed many times on the show, thanks to, again, your guidance and expertise, I mean, the greyhound racing world is a very complicated world, whether it's the laws in place that keep the dogs racing, even though the dog tracks themselves will freely admit they don't really care about it, but they're required to keep the card rooms going. And there's, I guess, some strong factions here and there that would actually want to work towards keeping Greyhound going. But again, I think the percentages in this case work in the favor of if it does get all the way to the ballot, that, like you say, it'd be hard to think why people would say, no, let's, despite all this, let's keep the dogs racing.
Yeah, it really is hard for me to imagine that people would support this industry if they knew what was going on behind the curtains. It's just amazing to me. And there are some jobs that will be lost of necessity, but change is hard. But this change would be dictated ultimately by the people of the state of Florida.
Right.
And I honestly believe they'll be on the right side of this issue.
Right. And I think one question that sort of borders on rhetorical, but one of our emailers did ask, so if it's on the ballot for 2018 and 60% or more say, yep, that's in the greyhound racing, why would it be still till 2021 before that change is implemented?
The way Senator Lee has crafted the amendment is it reduces the requirement for the live racing by 1/3 each year. Currently, the law says they have to run 90% of the races they ran in 1996. So it would reduce it by 30% the first year, another 30% the second year, and in the third, at the end of the third year, ultimately eliminate the requirement to have the dog races. Again, that protects the animals. It doesn't dump. At any given time, there's about 8,000 dogs or more at the 12 tracks in Florida. It gives the rescue groups a chance to find appropriate homes for these dogs, as well as it gives the tracks a chance to adjust their business model to the more profitable card rooms.
Okay, so that's why if it does pass, it's still, we're looking at a better part of 3 years before it kicks in. But I think for a lot of people that felt like, would we ever see this kind of change? That's, it's not soon enough, but it's sooner than some would have predicted otherwise. So,
well, and again, leaving it up to the citizens of the state of Florida rather than the legislature, we honestly believe is a better way to go.
Yeah, well, we've seen that there's too many cross currents and conflicting agendas, and I still like, as you did, the thing that we never quite saw in print about the circular firing squad when it comes to some of those legislators dealing with this issue. So, yeah.
It's amazing. I mean, both houses last year approved decoupling, in other words, not requiring the live races in order to have the card rooms, but in committee, the whole bill was killed in committee, having nothing to do with decoupling.
Yeah, super complicated, and that's why this seems like the best prospect in some time. So let's keep our fingers crossed.
We're very excited, and we're hoping people will weigh in on this.
Yeah. All right, Don. Well, thanks again for filling us in and giving us the kind of specific info that we need to sort of be better informed on this pending constitutional amendment. So thank you again.
Duncan.
We'll keep things posted on this, and we'll ask you, as always, to be our guide in that way. So
great, and thank the Greenwoods for the work that they do too on behalf of us. That's wonderful.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, they're great people. So thanks. Okay, Don. Thanks again. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Duncan.
Okay.
Bye bye.
Coming up at 11 on WNF is Rob Lori in Radioactivity, kicking off a 3-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including the new hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., Craig Kopp and John Gilmore preside over executive session. I want to again remind you that on next week's show, we'll have that discussion of sexism, harassment, and other kinds of misconduct in the realm of animal welfare and animal rescue. Obviously a very timely topic, but it may be surprising for some listening what the circumstances are in that world. I hope you'll join me then. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachi and beyond, community conscious radio, homegrown, handpicked music and news, NPR news headlines, and then Rob Lori with Radioactivity. Thanks.